Hello, everyone. I'm going to talk about five people: Solomon, David, Elijah, Job, and Jeremiah. They all had struggles, serious struggles, I think, but all different. So I'm going to think a little bit about their struggles and what they did with them. We're going to start in Ecclesiastes 12. With Solomon. But before then, let me just show you this quickly. We don't need to turn to Acts chapter 16, but it might help us with Ecclesiastes 12. I'm sorry, the highlights are not in Persian, but if on the screen they are there. And what you may notice halfway through Acts chapter 16 is there's a pronoun change. Oh, sorry. Did I not? Excellent. Thank you. Okay. There's a pronoun change. We start off in for the first nine verses of Acts chapter 16. It's they, them, and so on. From verse 10 onwards, it changes to we and us. And we presume that's because Luke had joined the crowd of people. And so it was reasonable that, up to a certain point in time, it's them because he wasn't there. And then from verse 10, he's joined the group and he is with them. So that's Acts chapter 16. There is a similar thing going on in Ecclesiastes. The very first 11 verses of Ecclesiastes, the author is spoken about in the third person, the words of the preacher. Thus says the preacher, it says, and a number of times. So the person that's speaking in the first 11 verses, and then it changes in verse 12, I, the preacher. And all of a sudden, for the rest of the book, right down to chapter 12, it's I, all the way through. Yes, Ecclesiastes chapter 12, we sort of go back to this other person. And some people think it might be Hezekiah or some of his men who sort of packaging this up to collect some books together, added a little bit at the top and the end. Besides being wise, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, says Ecclesiastes 12. I don't know how well you can see this. I won't ask you to read this out. That is the entire of Ecclesiastes on one page. And you may be able to see the bit at the top is yellow. And then a bit at the bottom is yellow. And right over on the right-hand side, there's a little bit of yellow in the middle. But there we are. And so those are the places where maybe it's Hezekiah or one of his people that has sort of annotated the book in some way. So just as a quick summary, like the first 11 verses, the words of the preacher, somebody else, the son of David, and then it changes in verse 12 to I, and then at the end, it's back to being Hezekiah or somebody. So why is that important? So Ecclesiastes chapter 12, I said we would get there. We are there now. There's an interesting question, which is, does Solomon turn his life around? His life has had a ton of problems in it. Does he turn his life around? And what's interesting is if Ecclesiastes chapter 12 ends at verse 8, then it's quite a sorry picture at the end of his life. He ends, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And you may presume that is the end for what Solomon has written, because what follows is somebody else talking now. It's not Solomon, it's Hezekiah or one of his men or something like that. Besides being wise, the preacher also taught the people knowledge from verse 9 to the end of the book. But let's just think about the starts, the first eight verses of Ecclesiastes chapter 12. I'm going to read a bit of it from a modern translation, because I think sometimes modern translations hit home a bit. This is somebody who is old, very old, and listen to what they think. At that time, your arms will lose their strength. Your legs will become weak and bent. Your teeth will fall out. You will not be able to chew your food. Your eyes will not see clearly. You will be hard of hearing. You will be afraid of tripping over every small thing in your path. Your hair will become white like flowers on an almond tree. You will go to your eternal home, the mourners will gather in the streets as they carry your body to the grave. That's how it starts. It's not a happy picture, is it? And then vanity of vanities, all is vanity at the end. I imagine for Solomon, being smarter than everybody else was quite lonely. I mean, it's easy for us to be arrogant sometimes and think that we're cleverer than other people, but it's not the same as it was. For Solomon knew he was cleverer than everyone else. Half of the people around him were ill-informed. The other half will be miscalculated. And honestly, it's pointless for him to have corrected them because they wouldn't have understood a lot of the time. That was Solomon's existence. But worse, he had a desire to learn, a desire to find out more. And worse still, he had the power to experiment. And so he says, I turned my heart to know and search out and to seek wisdom and the scheme of things and to know the wickedness of folly and the foolishness that is madness. Unfortunately, he has the power to experiment. And we're familiar with how far he went off the rails with his many wives and the gods that they turned his heart to. 700 wives who were princesses, 300 concubines, and they turned away his heart. He was seriously off the rails. I also gathered from my silver and gold and treasure and kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and concubines to the delight of the sons of man, not to the delight of God. Vanity of vanities, he ends. All is vanity. Verse 8 does not leave the preacher in a good place at all. Solomon's problems were physical. As a result, he felt as though everything was futile, but he wasn't alone. This is a Psalm of David. I don't know exactly when it was written. Verse 1 of Psalm 6 is exactly the same as verse 1 of Psalm 38. Psalm 38 is likely about his feelings post Bathsheba. So we may think that this is a similar time. Verse 6, I am weary with my moaning. Every night I flood my bed with tears. I drench my couch with weeping. My eye wastes away because of grief. It grows weak because of all my foes. This is how David felt. Absolutely wretched. Foes there, he had literal people plotting to kill him. Or maybe it's just a metaphor for the depth of the hole that he felt that he was in. If Solomon's problems were physical, and as a result he felt that everything was futile, David's problem was his sin, and as a result he felt worthless and in a hole. So Elijah is interesting. 1 Kings chapter 18 has the story of Elijah and the prophets of Baal. He is trying to turn Israel to God. He thinks he can make Ahab listen. God has sent a famine and everyone is absolutely desperate. Elijah has agreed to meet Ahab and they've built these sacrifices and God has sent fire and it has consumed Elijah's sacrifice, but not Ahab's. And it is clear to everyone, absolutely crystal clear, that Baal is nothing and God is everything. The message could not be clearer. God's ended the famine and Elijah thinks he's made a breakthrough. He thinks that now the people will listen to him. But in the very next chapter, then Jezebel sent a message to Elijah saying, so may the gods do to me and more also if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by this time tomorrow. And Elijah's world comes crashing down, I think. The high of the breakthrough just vanishes. He himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree and asked that he might die, saying, this is enough now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am no better than my father's. I think he feels absolutely crushed by what he thought was going to be a success turning into just not that at all. Solomon's problems were physical, and as a result, he felt everything was futile. David's problems were his sin, and he felt that he was worthless. Well, Elijah's problems were that he was just overloaded with work, and he felt that he was drowning as a result. And well, Job, we can't ignore Job, can we? Job, chapter 3, he has lost everything. He's lost his health. He's lost his money. He's lost his family. And he has, you know, nothing but the dirt around him that he is sat on. Why did I not die at birth, come out from the womb and expire, he says in chapter 3. Why is light given to him who is in misery, and life to the bitter in soul, who long for death but it comes not, and dig for it more than for hidden treasures? Solomon's problems were physical, and he felt that everything was futile. And David's problems were sin, and he felt that he was worthless. And Elijah's problems were that he felt overloaded and as if he was drowning. Then Job's problems were loss. He had lost everything, and he had given up on life as a result. And finally, we can't ignore Jeremiah. Jeremiah's problems was that everyone around him had abandoned him. He's in chapter 20, he's been beaten, he's been placed in stocks, and he's been mocked. And he has a complete lack of friends and support. That's Jeremiah. Cursed be the day on which I was born, the day on which my mother bore me, let it not be blessed. Cursed be the man who brought the news to my father, a son is born to you, making him very glad. Let that man be like the cities that the Lord overthrew without pity. Let him hear the cry in the morning and the alarm at noon, because he did not kill me in the womb, because my mother would not have been my grave and her womb forever great. Why did I come out of the womb to see toil and sorrow and spend my days in shame? Solomon's problems were physical, and as a result, he felt that everything was futile. David's problems were sin, and so he felt that he was worthless. Elijah was overloaded and felt that he was drowning. Job's problems were his loss, and that he'd given up on life. And Jeremiah's problems were his lack of friends and support, and he wished that he had not been born. I think Romans chapter 8 is an amazing chapter and has something absolutely profound to say about this problem, although it is hard to understand. For the creation, it says, that's us, we are the creation here, was subject to futility. We are subject to the frustrations of our human existence, not willingly. It's not that we enjoy it at all, but because of him who subjected it. That's God. God made us as we are in hope. This is the key bit. That in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption to obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. Some of the pain in our life exists because God wants us to hope for perfection in his kingdom, I think is what we are being told. The existence of dark perhaps helps us to understand light sometimes. Where there is pain, there is hope, even if we can't see it. And that, I think, is the message of Romans chapter 8. So I'd just like to go back over the people we've looked at and see if they can see the hope. Could they see a way out of the hole that they were in? And well, with Jeremiah, it's easy because we have some of the words of Lamentations and words that we sing sometimes because they are uplifting to us. But this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore I will hope in him. I don't know if when he was in the stocks being mocked, whether he could have thought this. I suspect that in that moment, maybe he couldn't. But there's no doubt that later on he could see more clearly. Job chapter 19, famous verses in the middle of the book. Despite his pain, Job can see past it to the redemption through Jesus. For I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will stand upon the earth. After my skin has thus been destroyed, yet in my flesh shall I see God, says Job. He can see some hope. We have very little recorded of Elijah's words. Almost all of the words that Elijah speaks are God's words that he repeats. So we don't have recorded what he felt or what he said, but we do know that he continued to work for God. Despite the struggle, he continued to do God's work and to preach to God's people. He continued to be God's prophet. I stopped when we were thinking about David, and I stopped reading halfway through Psalm chapter 6. All you have to do is carry on, and you will see what David saw. His eyes are wasting away because of grief. And in verse 8, he says, "Depart from me, you workers of evil, for the Lord has heard the sound of my weeping. The Lord has heard my plea. The Lord accepts my prayer." And so David could see the hope. That is certain. Even in the midst of his pain, he could see the hope. And Ecclesiastes chapter 12, it's not clear exactly who is saying what at the end of the chapter, but I would like to think that Ecclesiastes chapter 12 and verse 13, however they are reported, are the words of Solomon. This is the end of the matter. All has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man, says Solomon. Even at the end, keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. So Solomon's problems were physical. As a result, he felt that everything was futile. Did he see hope in his predicament? Well, at the very least, he was exhorting people to keep God's commandments. David's problem was sin. He felt that everything was worthless. Did he see hope? He absolutely definitely did. And he trusted in God to save him as a result. Elijah's problems were that he was overloaded and he felt that he was drowning. Did he see the hope? Maybe not in the moment, but he did continue afterwards to trust God to help him work through the trouble. Job's problems were loss. He'd given up on life, but he did see hope. He trusted in God's long-term plan. Jeremiah's problems were his lack of friends and support. Maybe he didn't at the time in the stocks see hope, but he did believe that God's mercies never end. We're here to remember our Lord Jesus in breaking bread and drinking wine. Did Jesus experience the same sense of dread that the people we've been looking at? Did he manage to see hope? So we know that he experienced the same sense of dread. In the Garden of Gethsemane, he said to them, "My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch with me." This is how Jesus felt on the road to the cross. Did he see the hope? Well, he quotes Psalm 22 on the cross, and the desperation and the sense of dread is here as well. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me from the words of my groaning? Oh my God, I cry by day, but you do not answer, and by night, but I find no rest. The sense of dread is there for Jesus just the same. But the same chapter, just a few verses later, and this is in the present tense. This is not the future tense. This for Jesus is now. "For he has not despised or abhorred the affliction of the afflicted. He has not hidden his face from him, but he has heard when he cried to him. From you comes my praise in the great congregation. My vows I will perform for those who fear him." Jesus embodied all of the troubles of all of the people that we have spoken about. In some sense, he lived through all of them. Solomon was old. Well, they said of Jesus that he is old before his time. David was weighed down with his own sin. Jesus was weighed down with the sins of the world. Elijah was overloaded with work. I don't know how much you'd compare Jesus' workload to Elijah's, but I imagine at least the same. Job was burdened with loss. Well, Jesus was about to lose everything, more than Job lost. Jeremiah suffered from lack of friends and support, and Jesus knew that his disciples at this time were about to run away and abandon him. And all of the hope that everyone else had, Jesus had too. He kept God's commandments. He trusted God. He particularly trusted God to help him work through his troubles. He trusted in God's long-term plan, and he believed that God's mercies never end. And it's our Lord Jesus that we're going to remember now.